just as much as it surprised us. I never have found out why we had suddenly had the loyal oath administered to us so quickly while we were there, but that was that.
No kidding, it's very interesting.
That gets us pretty well through staff college.
Yeah,
and then, of course, while I was at staff college, as I say, King George VI died, and I and Mackay were both appointed to the Canadian Coronation Contingent as administrative officers. Mm-hmm. Mackay, who was the other Canadian student, worked as the Coronation Contingent Liaison Officer from the Canadian headquarters in London, and I acted as the liaison officer from the position of the troops in the field at their major camp in Pirbright in Surrey. And between us, we saw that they all had proper equipment, that they all got invitations to British country houses, that they all were given an opportunity to go on tour, that they had an opportunity to accept invitations and so on. It was a very, very busy time mm-hmm. until after the coronation was over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Between 53 and 56, you were posted to the British Army War Office itself as a liaison officer in land air warfare. And just bearing in mind that by training, by profession, you were involved in the infantry, did in particular, the air warfare aspect require of you to expand or acquire new skills?
I've always wondered about why I was posted to that job, because I had no skills and no experience whatsoever in it. And I've come to the conclusion that it was because during the time I was at the Royal Canadian School of Infantry, the Director of Military Intelligence in Ottawa, and the Staff College, during that period of time, my battalion, the PPCLI, had changed its role from that of straight infantry to becoming a parachute battalion. So back home, everybody who was PPCLI was assumed to be a parachutist. So when looking at my record, they said, oh, we've already got a member of the PPCLI overseas. let's make him the land air warfare liaison. Yeah, bold assumptions, again, looking at documents, and so I wasn't asked, but I was posted to the War Office. I was delighted because I was enjoying myself over there.
You were also, I believe, also engaged in amphibious operations as well.
Well, it went with the job. We had no amphibious experts in the Canadian forces anyways, and so there was, I see nothing wrong with appointing practically anybody as the amphibious liaison officer. But as a land air warfare officer, I had to immediately start taking courses. I took a parachute course with the SAS regiment, and I took the air transport support course and the offensive support course, mm-hmm. or the ground liaison officer's course at the British Army Air Training and Development Center at Old Sarum in Salisbury Plains. And then I became an expert in land air warfare.
That time spent with the SAS, that's known as a fairly elite unit of the British forces. How did they react or respond to quote-unquote foreigner interference? Were they open, or were they somewhat secretive about it?
They were delighted. The SAS has always been a rather unhomogeneous group of people. And they've had Canadians and other people in it before. Mm-hmm. When I was appointed the job, the SAS really consisted of the 21st SAS, brackets, Artists Rifles, which was an old-time territorial army regiment from the London area, and which in World War I had produced officers. And it was always a bit of an elite group, but they were strictly territorial or militia training people. There was another regiment out in Malaysia called 22 SAS, and that was a specialized unit that wasn't really working in the They're called the Malayan Rifles, I think they're called the Malayan Rifles. So they were working in a ground role, not in an airborne role out in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. While I was in the War Office, however, it was decided that the SAS should become a regular unit of the British Order of Battle, and I sat down and wrote the first pamphlet on the SAS regiment, and also shepherded the various documents that had to go through all the various branches of the War Office, eventually end up with the Queen signing the regular commission for the regiment. And that was an interesting experience. I met all sorts of interesting people who were colonels of regiments and who were commanders of the home forces and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. You know, that would be Mickey Redstone's contact there.
And I continually kept contact. Having trained with them, I went down and attended nearly all their functions at the 16 Duke of York's Road, their armories down, and became very good friends with some of the senior members of the SAS regiment.
Mm-hmm.
I went on exercises in Norway with them, jumped into Norway with them, and I went on exercises with them in Germany. And altogether, I had a close relationship and friendships that last to this day, although in the last 3 years I haven't heard from Major Greville Bell, who was one of the people that was a long time SAS.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't object to a Canadian at all.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, just one more thing.
Sure.
It's an interesting carry-on from that is that during the Malaysian crisis, the New Zealanders decided that they would send an independent SAS squadron to Malaysia. That was when the, I'll just leave it at Malaysian crisis, you can look it up in your history books. They asked the War Office if they would send out an establishment for an independent SAS squadron. And the War Office had never had such a thing post-war as an independent SAS squadron designed to work in the jungles, and so they had to draw one up. And I represented the Director of Land Air Warfare in drawing up the SAS squadron. I forget the name of the person who represented the supply and transport people in the War Office, but he was a Canadian major from the Royal Canadian Army Service Corps. And the infantry aspect of it was represented by a chap named Gordon Sellers, who was a Calgary Highlander during the war, and a Canadian too. So three Canadian officers sat down in the War Office and drafted the establishment of an independent squadron for a New Zealand SAS regiment. I've always thought that was an amusing incident. Well, the establishment was approved and accepted and went out to New Zealand, and I understand they modified it just very slightly, and eventually a New Zealand SAS squadron appeared in Malaysia.
During your time in the War Office, essentially you were observing British tactics in inland warfare, amongst other things, and reported anything of interest to Ottawa.
Essentially, I was observing British airborne equipment. The mm-hmm. tactics, once the parachutist has landed on the ground, the tactics are almost the same as they are with standard infantry. They're a little more lightly equipped, and consequently, they don't take on as heavy an enemy and so on. But just the same, it's from the time they are standing on the ground until the time they're standing back on the ground, it's largely a difference of equipment, and that's what the Canadian Army was interested in. Parachutes, heavy drop equipment, how to rig things, the shape of aircraft, the usefulness of vehicles, and all this kind of thing.
By and large, did the Canadian forces adopt recommendations that you would eventually pass on? Were British tactics in that respect?
Yes, they did. They adopted a number of bits of equipment, and I really never made recommendations because I had no idea what they were receiving, for instance, from the Canadian Army liaison officer on land air warfare in the United States, and what was coming from France and what was coming from the other places that had it. But I used to send back full detailed working drawings and results of experiments and the results of how it was used on exercise and so on. And several pieces of British equipment were taken into use by the Canadian forces.
Mm-hmm. Between 1956 and 58, you bounced around from one part of the globe to the other. Initially posted in 1956 to Calgary as the HQ company commander for PDCLI. And shortly thereafter, for a short time, you were in Palestine as part of the UN peacekeeping force. How was it in Palestine? Did the unit as a whole go over?
No, the unit did not go as a whole. There was a large number of peacekeeping operations that Canada was involved in and has been involved in and is still involved in, which required military observers or truce supervisors or whatever they want to call them depending upon the mission they're on. And these always required officers in the rank of major. Well, there aren't all that many officers in the rank of major in the Canadian Army that are qualified to go out in the field and act as a referee, if you like, between two fairly hostile groups. And I was one of them. I would say that nearly every infantry, armored, and artillery major in the Canadian forces has at one time been on some kind of a peacekeeping mission of some sort or another. So I was just nominated to that in the normal course of affairs, and I went out and spent a year, 6 months in Jerusalem, 3 months in Tiberias, and 3 months in Damascus.
Mm-hmm. As you said, you were there for approximately 1 year. Then you were back to the 1st Battalion of PDCLI here in Victoria at Work Point, assigned shortly thereafter to an officer training program
Well, I took over B Company of the battalion in Work Point Barracks.
Right.
And I had just taken, in fact, I hadn't even unpacked my kit when the adjutant called me in and said, "Sir, you've been told that you're going to run the officer's training course." I mentioned before that the professional advancement of officers depended on passing examinations.
Mm-hmm.
Each battalion tried to give its officers the best deal they could so that they could pass these examinations. So every year or twice a year, they set aside a couple of weeks, 2 week or a 3 week period in which their junior officers who wanted to write their examinations were given concentrated study time and assistance. Now, I was designated to run this particular 3 week period for the battalion along with a number of junior instructors. And so I did. I ran it at Albert Head, and before I finished running it at Albert Head, the battalion had been broken up to receive new colors from Her Majesty the Queen at Beacon Hill Park. Where are we now? I guess this is 1950.
Somewhere in 50, middle 58, perhaps. You were there. In fact, it's probably in January 58, and you were there for probably 9 months.
I think it was 58 then. No, it'd be 59. Somehow or other, we got strong. 57 to 58, I was in Palestine because I didn't get back to Canada until March 56. Anyways. The Queen was coming to present colors to the battalion, so my company had been broken up into what we call guards, since they take the whole battalion and size it, tallest on the right, shortest on the left, in three ranks size, so that the guards look the same size, the men in the guards look the same size as they are doing this very complicated ceremonial. So I never did see my company then. By the time we had practiced trooping the color, had trooped the color for the Queen, the battalion was reformed, had to go on a civil defense exercise. That was in the days when Canada was great on civil defense and the militia were largely involved in civil defense.
Mm-hmm.
The regular forces had a series of engagements up the island with various bits and pieces of militia to take part in civil defense exercises. So I never did have my company on the parade square. I got them, took them up the island. While I was up the island, I was posted to Ottawa. When I came back, my posting orders were there, and I had to depart almost immediately. At least I was on leave when I came back, giving me enough time to get everything settled. And I said, no way, I'm going to have at least once with this rifle company of mine that I have commanded now for approximately 6 months, I'm going to have at least once on parade. So I've got to look at every man in the rifle company and let them look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. So that was the posting which I commanded B Company, and I had them once as a company, on a formal parade, as their commander.
And then, within the space of a few months again, you found yourself in Wainwright, Alberta, at an NCO training school.
Yes, that's right.
You
yeah.
must have, by this point, you must have been getting a little weaker. You were bouncing around.
Well, I commanded the junior NCO school at Camp Wainwright in Alberta, and that was a school that trained all the junior NCOs from Western Command, all the combat arms junior NCOs, whether from Armored Corps,
mm-hmm.
infantry, artillery, or engineers. They came to take this course, and that was a very interesting course. I enjoyed it tremendously. It was right down my line. I'd done a lot of training in my time, particularly battle drill instructor for months, so I knew a great deal about the basic infantry unit tactics, which all candidates used,
mm-hmm.
even though they may have been gunners or artillery. They were really leadership training.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was on my way back from that, of course, I found I'd been posted to Ottawa.
To the, in fact, Canadian Army Operational Research Establishment, which, in effect, you were a researcher and involved with the, quote, war game.
That's right. There are a number of branches to the Canadian Army Operational Research Establishment. One of the bigger branches is the wargaming branch, where concepts are tested out in war games, and even some items of equipment are tested out in war games. For instance, if you have the problem as to whether you should be able to fire 6 rounds a minute with a less accurate sight or a more accurate sight that allows you to fire 3 rounds a minute much more accurately, which will give you the best battle results? Well, the way you can do this is to war game it both ways, changing only that one parameter, and do this for a long period of time and see what the outcome is. That's a simple sort of example, but we did this with a large number of things, with new equipment that had different characteristics and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this was most interesting war gaming. I eventually became the senior red commander. So for a few months, I had to think, live, and act like a Soviet battalion brigade or divisional commander, and I studied their tactics very closely.
But you were involved on a higher level in terms of not just purely battle tactics, but also nation versus nation?
No, we were strictly battle tactics. We did nothing but war game battles. There was no strategy in it. The highest formation involved was about a division on the blue side and maybe an army on the red side. But you could still see, at the very highest level war game, you could still see infantry, single infantry battalions on the board. At the very lowest level war game, you could see individual men, tanks, machine guns, and so on. Sometimes took us a whole day to play 45 seconds of battle.
Did you find it particularly fascinating?
Yeah, I did. I found it very interesting, particularly having to get into the Soviet tactics and do a lot of reading on that. That was very interesting.
Presumably, in order to do that, you would have to get your hands on Soviet.
Oh yes, well, of course, that's right. Of course, I had a fairly high security classification. I mean, I didn't need anything higher than secret classification anyways. I was able to get hold of all the information I did. And I just loved to try and beat the blue forces. As a matter of fact, I think I'd make a successful Russian commander because on two or three occasions I did knock the blue forces all to bits.
From January 1962 through June 1965, approximately 3.5 years, first of all, you were promoted to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel and posted to the 2nd Battalion of, again, the PCLI in Edmonton. Those years were the beginning of what was later integration and unification. As a soldier, what were your impressions of that? Were you favorably disposed towards that?
Well, it started off with integration, and I think every soldier could see a certain amount of intelligence in it. You know, a cook is a cook is a cook, and why does he have to live forever in a Navy environment? He could change around, and the same thing with a clerk is usually a clerk, and there are a lot of things that could be unified at various levels. But when it came to what they called integration, that is, try to make everybody look exactly the same as a member of the armed forces. And in fact, as history now, everybody got in the same uniform, and we very nearly lost our regimental badges and buttons so that we would look all an amorphous lot. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a soldier, a sailor, or an airman, let alone the difference between what regiment a person belonged to if he was a soldier. Mm-hmm. That, it fortunately never went that far, and it never really had a great effect below what in the Army is brigade level. In other words, all the infantry battalions, companies, platoons, and everything else, as far as they were concerned, outside of the fact that they now had a green uniform, they were not unified. You know, soldiers couldn't still man ships, and sailors still couldn't fly airplanes, and so on. So unification.
Initially, from that aspect, made sense, was useful and made sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Integration made sense. Unification didn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm. Through 1967, you were posted to what became known as Mobile Command as Chief of the Infantry. In fact, in charge of all operational forces connected with the Army.
All infantry.
All infantry, sorry, yeah, a little broad. And also promoted to the rank of Colonel at that time. Shortly after that, through 1970, rather, you were posted back to Ottawa again as Director of Training for the Canadian Forces as a whole. You also asked me at this time to have you relate to your copybook episode.
Oh, well, first I'd like to say that as Chief of Infantry at Mobile Command, I was partially instrumental, although there was a large amount of support for the move by a fairly wide spectrum of senior officers in taking out of the order of battle the Guards Regiment, the Black Watch, and the Queen's Own. It was found that we simply couldn't keep that many regiments with the number of men we had, and in some cases we were rotating men through units so quickly that he would have served in four or five regiments in a normal tour and could develop no loyalty to any particular one regiment. So we reduced the number of regiments to the standard three, the Royal 22nd, the Royal Canadian Regiment, and the PPCLI. And each man had a tendency to serve in his regiment and reestablished our regimental tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point about that. While I was director of training, I was theoretically Although this was a new organization, and we weren't quite clear how it ran or where authority lines were fitted, but theoretically in charge of all the training units of the Canadian Forces. And this includes, for instance, the Air Navigation School at Winnipeg, their Survival School at Edmonton, the Language Training School that we had that really worked for intelligence, the Fleet School in Halifax, the schools of infantry, armor, artillery, and engineers, and so on, as a director of training. It's all very interesting. I spent a lot of time looking at all of them and doing what I could to help all of them, but I'm not sure that the director of training, as it was organized when I was in, was really a very useful role, and I was rather relieved when I was removed from it or posted onward.
Yeah, what about the episode of the copy book?
That really goes back to the time when I was commanding the 2nd Battalion PPCLI. At that time, we had a fairly large contingent of Canadian forces out in Ghana supporting this rather rude person, Kwame Nkrumah, who I took a very, very dull view of indeed. During the time I was commanding the 2nd Battalion, each year, in fact, each officer is reported on by a personal evaluation report, which leaves him a space to say what he thinks about the whole thing. So his senior officer reports on him, and he has an opportunity to make a statement. I had been told unofficially, and probably that's what caused the trouble, that I might be selected to go to Ghana to assist Kwame Nkrumah with training his army and running the Canadians in Ghana. And I wrote on my confidential report, I said, that I think it's disgraceful that the Canadian force has anything to do with a person like Kwame Nkrumah, and that I would rather resign my commission than do anything that actually was helpful to maintaining his regime in Ghana. And I thought, put your money where your mouth is. And they never asked me to resign my commission, but this was held against me, as I was told later by a senior officer, and it said that it had delayed my consideration for promotion because they didn't think officers of the Canadian Forces should take that kind of a viewpoint. They should do what they were bloody well told and get on with it, no matter what it was. It was a matter of government policy. And on mature reflection, I tend to agree with them, but I still would have resigned my commission rather than go out and serve Kwame Nkrumah.
I'm sure that's probably a dilemma that a lot of officers in Maine.
A lot of officers were placed in dilemmas, I think, like that. I know one very an excellent young officer who lives in Victoria still at the moment, who blotted his copybook in the same way when he was out in Ghana, being asked to do something that was unconscionable, and he refused to do it. Well, this is tantamount to disobeying an order. When he came back, he resigned his commission and left the forces. You can get a hold of him and talk to him if you want.
A very untenable position, I imagine, for some people. Just jumping up a little bit here, 1972, you were posted to the military component of the Canadian delegation for control and supervision in Vietnam for approximately 6 months period. What were your impressions while on that delegation? What is the Canadian delegation viewed with some skepticism by the United States insofar as the Canadians were?
I don't know what the United States did. The delegations were what was called a CHIP, Canadian, Hungarian, Indonesian, Poland. There were no United States people there, except they were on the ground, still there. But they did really nothing for us except administer us and help us as much as they could. They certainly never offered us any advice at my level anyways. The Canadian, because the language of the mission was officially English, the Indonesians spoke it, the Hungarians and Poles didn't speak anything in common, and the Canadians spoke it, so English was the language most used, and it was used as the language of the mission. Because of this, the Canadians had a rather leading role in establishing these, because all the others worked through interpreters, and we had language difficulties. It was very interesting. I commanded, or I shouldn't say I commanded, because, but I was a senior Canadian officer in the largest region of Vietnam, South Vietnam. That's the mountainous region of the Plai Khu region. And it ran all the way from Cam Ranh Bay, which was a large naval base in the south, to the area held by the Viet Cong in the northwest. And so there was a wide variety of countryside and a wide variety of contacts. And we found it a fascinating 6 months.
Did you find during that period, were the Hungarians and the Poles, did you get the impression perhaps that they were toting a Soviet line? Were they getting instructions at all from...
I don't think they were... Well, they may have been towing a Soviet line, but as far as they were concerned, they weren't receiving instructions by anybody but their government. What their government back in Poland and Hungary were doing, I don't know. But the officers out there are obviously pro-Viet Cong, in other words, pro-communist. So there are two pro-communists and two, if you like, pro-United States, although the Indonesians were not as friendly with the United States as we were. So we were... And we might as well face it, we were pro-United States. We were so pro-United States that we leaned over backwards not to be pro-United States. And to some extent, this affected our judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no doubt the Hungarians and Poles were speaking with an East Bloc single voice on nearly everything we did.
Yeah, I don't suppose that came as much of a surprise.
No, that was totally expected. Other than that, on non-official matters, we got along splendidly together. We had most magnificent parties on our national days. I remember on July the 1st, Canada entertaining all the delegations, and the party started off rather sedately in the early afternoon when we had local distinguished civilians, the governor of the province, and everybody invited to attend, and ended up in the small hours of the next morning drinking
Hungarian
brandy made of apricots of some very, very strong stuff, with the Poles drinking schnapps, and it was a tremendous party. We all enjoyed ourselves tremendously outside of our official formal
capacity.
Yeah.
As we said, you were there for about 6 months, and then by late 1973, you were back in Canada as deputy commander of the brigade group. Promoted at this time, also to the rank of Brigadier General, and were with the 1st Canadian Infantry Brigade Group in Calgary. After that, you were there for approximately 2 years, approximately a year, I guess.
Well, no, as a matter of fact, I actually commanded the brigade for about 3 months, and then I proceeded to Canadian Forces Base Gagetown, take over command of Gagetown, which is the largest training base in the British Commonwealth.
Did you find, and that was, Gagetown represents essentially your last command.
It was my last command, yes.
Did you find that sort of a satisfactory or a suitable way to wind down what was
a... Yeah, I did. I found it a most suitable way. I had spent most of my life in training, as a training expert at all levels. And this was the biggest training base in Canada. It trained all the combat arms, except for the engineers who had their particular school still out at Chilliwack. But the artillery, armor, infantry were all training jointly together with helicopters and with all sorts of ancillary forces that were there. And it was a really very interesting 2 years.
Looking back over your career, as we said, this was your last command, and you were with the forces for approximately 35 years. Looking back, was there, either during the wartime period or post-war, was there one thing or one highlight for you that particularly sticks out, or just a chance to make a lot of friends with that?
There is no doubt whatsoever that the highlight of any infantry officer's career is the period of command of his own battalion. This was a fabulous battalion. It was a parachute battalion to start with. It belonged to a specialized group of people who trained in Arctic warfare. So besides having to be infantry specialists, we also had to be airborne specialists as well as Arctic specialists. We lived at the gates of the Arctic, and we trained to go into the Arctic, and we operated in the Arctic and everything, which was something none of the other battalions did. As a result of this, we had a first-class bunch of senior NCOs, and we had young, keen, fit men who were with the battalion. They wouldn't last very long if they had to parachute into the Arctic unless they were fit. And we did that. We parachuted in the Arctic at 50 below zero. We operated in the Arctic at, we didn't operate when it got below 50 below zero, but we existed in the Arctic at 70 and more degrees below zero. So it was a first class battalion. I enjoyed my tour with it tremendously. I was able to achieve all the objects I wanted. All the time I was in command, the battalion always walked away with every sports meet they entered into. They were always a superior battalion in tactics and in movement. They knew their job, and it was just gorgeous. I was quite ready to quit the forces the day I left my battalion. Mm-hmm. In fact, everything thereafter was an anti-climax.
Well, Brigadier General McGregor, we are rapidly winding down here, so I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you for taking the time up to chat with us and to recount your career. So on behalf of myself and the History Department, thank you very much.
A pleasure.